You're listening to the Darebin Fuse Festival. This five-part podcast series is a collaboration with the First Time Podcast and is part of Darebin's Spring Festival program. Conversations were recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and we'd like to acknowledge them as the traditional owners and custodians of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future. Episodes in this Fuse series will be released fortnightly and feature local creatives Kate McLennan, Leanne Hall, Eve Reese, Clementine Ford, and McKinley Valentine. Happy listening. McKinley Valentine is a newsletter maker and newsletter evangelist. She makes The Whippet, which is a collection of interesting bits of history and science, personal digressions, and unsolicited advice. You can subscribe to The Whippet at thewhippet.org, and I highly recommend you do. McKinley is also an emerging fantasy writer. Her short fiction has been published in Andromeda Spaceways, In-Flight Magazine, and Seizure. McKinley, let's start at the very beginning. Did you always want to be a writer?
So I was certainly an early and rabid reader. I use books as an escape, as a lot of, I think, weird introverted kids do. And I like the idea of being able to give people better worlds that they could live in. But I didn't actually write a whole lot as a kid. And I know some writers do, but I was always making worlds. Like when my brother and I were grounded, he would be on the top bunk and I would be the bottom and we'd pass them back up to each other and have the other person finish the map, or we draw villages out of clay, or we made a whole medieval town out of cardboard once. So things like that were definitely big for me.
In terms of writing, do you remember the first thing that you had published or that you sort of showcased to a bigger audience?
So there were probably one or two things as a kid, but the thing that really stands out is there was a comedy website called crack.com. It still exists, but it's been bought up and they bite all the writers and now it's just rehashed content. So I would not bother visiting it. And at the time I used to read the site every day and I was absolutely obsessed with it. And they agreed to publish something that I wrote. And I remember being the most excited about anything I've been in my life. Like that feeling when you can physically feel it in your heart. And my reaction was, I need to quash that feeling because just because they've said yes, it's not actually published yet. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. And so I shouldn't get too excited so I don't get disappointed. And then when it actually was published, I kind of didn't care because I'd spent so much time quashing my excitement that I actually almost didn't tell anyone the day it came out because it just felt like an admin duty to let people know. So I learned a lesson from that, which is don't try and quash your happiness because you don't, you know, it's not necessarily reliable.
I feel like publication in general is like that though sometimes. Like it's something you work towards so much and then when you get the thing, it actually showing it to the world is a much more nuanced. There are so many more emotions that sit behind it rather than unadulterated happiness.
Certainly even now my feeling of publication is often more like when I get good feedback, my feeling is not so much, oh, they loved it, yay. It's like, oh, thank God I didn't screw up.
Well, you get, I mean, that's what we're going to talk about today, but I guess putting something out into the world on a fortnightly basis means that opportunity for feedback is always existing, really, isn't it?
It is, although I would say that the amount of effort required to reply to an email is somewhat higher than the amount in a comment section. So you do tend to get a higher standard of feedback and more thought through. And it's often just people sharing their personal stories and ways in which they relate, which is just interesting. You do get sometimes some like, well, actually, you forgot to mention, and they make me a bit crazy because I'm like, I didn't forget. I just didn't include it because it's a newsletter, not an entire book on the topic. But I try not to reply with that tone of voice and just say, thanks, cool, and not, yeah.
So, I mean, you are the author of a very, very popular newsletter called The Whippet. For those people that don't know what newsletters are, what is a newsletter?
So, I mean, in the most basic form, it's just a piece of short writing that arrives in people's inbox. And from there, it can be really anything that you write, fiction, poetry, travel writing, essays, political commentary, literally anything. But the difference, I guess, is that a newsletter used to be maybe updates from an author that they'd like. They tell you when they had a new book out or when they were speaking near you or things like that. Whereas now it is a medium for content in itself. And I think that what's great about it is that compared to almost any other medium, it's an ongoing connection with the reader, because if you see something someone's written that you like and it's on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and you read it and you think, awesome, that was great, but you're probably not going to remember to go back and check that blog once a week for the next year. But if you have a newsletter, then you read something and you think, I love that piece of writing, I want to hear more from this person. Oh, they have a newsletter. All I have to do is put my email address in here and I don't have to track this or think about it or manage it anymore. And I'm just going to hear from them whenever they have something new to say.
And so how did you begin to discover newsletters? Because it's a relatively recent kind of thing in some ways.
Yeah. There's a few really old running ones. One of the really oldest ones, I think there's a lesson here about naming your newsletter a little bit abstractly so it can change as what you want to write about change. There's a newsletter called Book Slut, which was by a woman who was writing book reviews and book criticism, who now writes almost exclusively about tarot. But the newsletter is still called Book Slut. So it's like probably harder to convey to new readers, I imagine. So I started mine around the Trump election because you couldn't read or look at the news or look at Twitter or look at literally anything without hearing infinite Trump news. And not that it wasn't important, but I was sick of it. But you can't just turn off social media, especially because there's stuff that I love about the internet. I love when you read something and it makes your brain light up and you're like, ah, that's so cool. And so I wanted to make something that would give you the good parts of the internet without all of those parts. I was also quite addicted to Facebook at the time. And that was partly because when I read something interesting, I have an enormous urge to share it. And I needed an outlet for sharing stuff that was not Facebook. Especially this was around the same time as the Cambridge Analytica scandal. So I didn't really want to support them. And a lot of my friends were saying things like, you know, I love your posts on Facebook because it's a lot of the stuff that is now in the with it. You're the only reason that I'm still on Facebook. And that did not make me feel good, even though it's a compliment. So that was another big reason for trying to find a new format.
And so you had the concept. What happened next?
The big thing, I guess, was I decided that I didn't want to be, you know, sometimes you go to a blog and there's three posts and they're all 6 months apart and each one begins, I'm so sorry, I haven't written in so long. And I thought, I don't want to do that. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to commit to it. Because if I can't commit to a regular writing habit, then I don't have a chance sort of at success at being able to write at any of that. So I made a very firm personal commitment and treated it like a non-negotiable deadline. And as a result, I have put something, it was originally weekly, I changed to fortnightly because weekly was too much. And have being able to put something out every fortnight for now about 3 years has been really, I think, transformative.
I guess one of the most striking things about The Whippet is the voice that you write in. It's so strong and so distinct. Was that always... Yeah, it's true. Was it always there? Was it something that evolved over time, do you think?
It definitely started out more dry. I sort of used it because The Whippet is a mix of my own writing and curated content. And I was using the curated content as a Trojan horse for my own writing. Because if it had just been what I'd written, then I would have had pretty bad imposter syndrome. But by having these other articles that other people who were better writers than me that had written, I could sort of be like, well, they can just skip the intro. They can ignore the bit that I write and they can just read the interesting other stuff. And that kind of gave me a safe space to start developing my own writing a bit alongside of it. There's one thing I've been thinking about in terms of voice a lot recently, which is, you know how when you're around different people, they bring out different parts of you. And there's people who, when you're around them, you're just kind of funnier and smarter and you like who you are more. And there's people who, for some reason, when you're around them, you just feel like you're negative and complaining all the time. And it might not even be anything wrong with the person, but people just bring out different parts of you. So I've been thinking about when you write a newsletter, what do you want? If that newsletter is kind of like a companion that you're going to be with every week or every fortnight or every month, what do you want that companion to bring out in you? What is your best self? Who do you want to be? And so that's, I think, related to voice. Like I have another voice that you don't hear in The Whippet, which is a very angry, very political voice. And there's nothing wrong with that voice, but it's not who I want to be all the time. I actually have a quote here, which is, it was a tweet that I read the other day that I thought was perfect, which is by a writer called Sarah Ahmed. Working out what kind of writing you want to do is not different from working out what sort of relationship with the world you want to have.
That's lovely. I love the idea of the newsletter being a companion, because so often we think of writing that we do as part of ourselves, whereas that's a nice separation or distinction to have. Like it's, you are a part of it or a reflection of it, but it's a bit protective in some ways.
Yeah, I see what you mean, yeah.
Are you conscious about your audience when writing newsletters?
I definitely am. I talk a lot about how you should follow your own interests and not try to appeal to a broad audience, and if it sparks your curiosity, it'll be of interest to someone else. And I do believe that, but I also put a lot of care and effort into communicating so that I'll be understood and it's not just my own esoteric brain. My day job is in plain language editing, which is about translating maybe government language or legal language or things like that into just easily understood English. And I really believe in that work. And so there's a lot of ways in which I make sure that even when I'm being kind of esoteric or highbrow, that I'm making it understandable. Like, I made a reference to the "but doctor, I am Pagliacci" joke, and I put a hyperlink in it to the joke in full so that if you wanted to click, you could. If I use words that I think might not be well understood, I often hyperlink out to the definition. I think I've had readers say that it's a smart newsletter that doesn't make them feel dumb, and I really value that as praise.
Mm. And how much do you know about your audience? Is it?
Not a lot. Because people do write to me, but it's a tiny subset of the whole readership. I know that it's about a third Americans, a third Australian, and the rest mostly sort of UK and MISC. That does influence me, because in terms of that wanting to make sure I'm understood, I know that Australianisms will not necessarily be understood. At the same time, I don't necessarily want to lose my Australian tone, and I do use Australian spellings, even though occasionally people think those are incorrect. And there is a bit of tension there because, yeah, I do want to be understood by other audiences, but I also can be frustrated by the fact that, particularly with America, Americans are used to having everything translated for them and not used to having to do it for other people. And I sometimes feel like I'm maybe doing too, I don't know. I don't have an exact answer for that, but I'm sometimes not totally comfortable with how much work I'm doing there.
Have you ever had instances where people have misunderstood?
I think not at a language level. I've had misunderstandings that come from when you talk about emotionally heightened topics, and there's a tendency of people, if there's a popular opinion about something and you say something that sounds a bit like that opinion, they will just kind of slot it into that shape of "you must be saying all of these things," rather than what you actually did say. So that happens a bit. Mainly around, I have some opinions around, I guess, family and emotional obligation and things like that that sometimes bother people, which is to say, I don't think you should be that obligated.
So is it a discussion sometimes? I mean, you've mentioned that people write to you.
Mm.
Do you form relationships with readers ever through that process?
Yeah, I usually write back quite long emails because I don't know how to write short emails, and because people are often sharing quite personal things, or sharing quite a lot of their heart or things that matter to them. And part of me feels like, you know, I've just written however many thousand words in your inbox, and I don't know, it feels like the least I can do is listen to what someone else has to say back, although I'm probably going to have to curtail that because it does take a lot of time. But there's people I'm definitely aware of when I see people's names in my inbox, like I have a continued sense of who they are. And there's one reader who's an ongoing friend who I've met up with in real life, who is a delight. Caitlin Bolter, if you're listening to this, you're great.
Do you have any interactions with readers that really stand out aside from making friends? Is there something nice or odd or interesting that's happened?
There was one time which was an absolute delight to me. I put in unsolicited advice, a organization tip, which I can recommend to any listeners now, which is if you have an untidy area, like all of your oil bottles on the shelf next to the stove, or a bunch of vitamins and tablets, if you have them all in one place or anything, put it on a square tray and you don't have to do any tidying, or rectangle tray or whatever. You just put all of the random junk onto a tray and it suddenly looks neat and tidy. It's incredible. And when I said that, a bunch of people sent me photos of before and afters of spaces that they had put things on trays or on pieces of cardboard, and that was a joy.
I wonder what Marie Kondo would think about that.
She would tell me to actually sort through my stuff instead of just putting it on a tray, I'm sure.
Or put it in your fire escape. She's been on fire escape. McKinley, what sorts of things have you done to grow the Whippet?
Yeah, look, I've tried a few sort of marketing things. I've done promoted tweets and Facebook ads and things. None of them have been massively successful. Like, it's, you're sort of paying maybe a dollar or two per subscriber, which to me is, without a sort of $10,000 budget, stops really being worth it. And compared to, by far the biggest thing that has grown the newsletter is things like going on podcasts or having someone who has their own podcast recommend the With It. And that is so successful compared to any other marketing attempts that I think the only thing you can really do is try and write something that other people want to share. I actually have a quote about this, which was absolutely transformative for me in a lot of ways around these ideas. It's from, it's by Sarah Pinsker, and it's actually a book on organizing related to Marie Kondo. It's about the idea of how when you try and throw stuff out or get rid of it, you struggle because you're like, I shouldn't just get rid of this though. This is worth something. I could sell it on eBay. And then you end up holding onto it for a million years. So she says, if every time you go to purge, you worry that an item is worth something or too good to give to charity, then you suffer from the rag picker syndrome. My great grandfather was a rag picker by trade. He bought an old dress in one shtetl to tear up and sell for rags in the next. To engage in rag picking is to pursue a noble but time-consuming profession. But the question you must ask yourself is it your profession? And when I read that, I was like, oh, wow. Because I didn't do the Whippet because I wanted to get into marketing. Like, some of it is necessary, but, you know, I get a little money from the Whippet, but it's not really a serious source of income. And, you know, I'm a copywriter. If I want to do work, if I want to write something that is not of interest to me, then I can get paid a lot more for it than I can trying to do marketing for the Whippet. So it involves a certain amount of acceptance that growth is going to be slower than it would be if I was willing to do all of that sort of work. But when I remind myself, you know, what profession do I want to have, that makes the decision for me.
I feel like all artists struggle with that to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to imply
it's
that
true.
We shouldn't do any marketing and or anything like that. Just that it's a trade-off, and the decision I've made is that that's not how I want to spend my time, and that I'm willing to accept slow growth in exchange for it.
Good one. Can you talk us through writing process? How does the newsletter get put together each fortnight?
Okay. So I use a couple of extensions, as in Chrome or Firefox extensions. One is called Pocket, and that is for articles. And whenever you're reading an article and you think that, or I shouldn't even say think, it's not that you think that that sounds interesting, it's that you feel a spark of curiosity or emotion, then you hit the little Pocket button and it saves it. And then later when you're thinking, oh God, what am I going to write about? You open Pocket and it's all of the articles that you've saved. And then relatedly, I use a notes taking app. I use Dynalist, but there's a lot. And similarly, whenever this is the same sort of standard writer's notebook stuff. When I hear myself saying something that I think is interesting or where I clearly care about it, I will stop and take out my notes app and write it down. And so I think that.
So on your phone, you just type it into your phone.
Yeah, on my phone. You could use pen and paper notebook if that's what you have on you all the time. It's really about. So what I think it's less about finding content because we're all consuming constant content all the time. It's more about learning to pay attention to when you have an emotional reaction or when you notice yourself being curious or caring about something, to have a part of your brain notice that so that you stop and save it somewhere. The other thing I do is a much less sort of organized thing, which is the day before the Whippet has to be done, I talk to my husband and say, what have I been talking about this week? Tell me my opinions. And he reminds me of some conversations we've had and is very helpful in that way.
Some issues must be harder than others.
Yeah. And I think it's more, you know, I said that I rely on that emotional impulse. There's sometimes when I go back through Pocket and I look at articles, and because I'm in a bad mood for whatever other reason, I'm like, all of this is boring. There is not a single thing in the world that is interesting or worth talking about, which is not correct, but you know how your mood can do that to you. And that makes it a lot harder to judge. I think the thing that I'm good at and is why people liked my Facebook post and now the Whippet is I don't just collect content. I try and pick the thing out of it that is going to be interesting to other people, that is why they should read it or that is why they should care, which you need to do because, again, content on the internet is infinite, but if you can tell someone what's interesting or what matters, then that is a value. But there are times when nothing seems of interest to me and nothing seems of value, and then I kind of have to just use my intellect brain and hope for the best.
So do you always Is it the day before the whippet comes out that you do the writing of it, or not necessarily?
Yes, but sorry. This is an ongoing, like, I absolutely should do it early, and I probably never will.
This is deadlines, though, isn't it?
Like, yeah, we all work to deadlines. And I mean, sometimes it's literally like it was going out at 7 a.m. and sometimes I would be finishing it at 6:59 a.m. after having stayed up all night drinking coffee because I hadn't started until the last minute. And
so you will do that. There's no the 7 a.m. is a firm.
Yeah.
That's good.
If I didn't,
it's symbolic on some level, isn't it?
If I didn't believe that, because the deadline is entirely self-imposed, if I didn't believe it was real, then it wouldn't work. And so it wouldn't just be not being at 7 a.m. one time. It would be being a day late and then 2 days late and then a whole issue late and the whole thing would fall apart. Maybe other people would be different, but for me, I needed to act as though the deadline was real or the whole system would fall apart.
One part of the whippet that you've already mentioned is unsolicited advice. Where did this come from?
So related to having terrible organizational skills and getting things done at the last minute, I have ADHD. And one of the things that that means is that I don't tend to pick up on social skills kind of naturally the way that other people might. I have to learn them relatively deliberately and manually by honestly, literally sometimes just Googling them. But like someone said, what does it mean when people do that? Or asking someone or watching people until I figure it out. And when I figure it out, I develop what I call in my head, although not out loud to anyone else, a policy with a capital P. And part of the reason I have those policies is also because in the moment when a decision is made on the spot, I often freeze up and I get overwhelmed by all of the environmental things and what people are saying and the stakes and all of that. And my brain stops working. So by having these policies that I can fall back on, I can act appropriately in the moment. And I found that for people who don't have the same struggles, there's still some area of their life where they don't really have everything down. And so all of the stuff that I've learned, I found has been really useful to people who don't have the same issues as me, because there's always something you can learn from it, I think. And I think in general, people who are bad at things are often the best person to learn from. Like if you've ever heard about like overcoming procrastination from someone who clearly has no problem with procrastination and their advice is like, you just knuckle down.
Yes, like, yes.
Oh. So,
it's
yeah,
like, I was thinking about weight loss or something. Just don't eat. Okay.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for advice from people who are actually not naturally particularly good at it. I will tell you one thing I learned, which is I was speaking to a friend with autism, so similar kind of learning social skills manually before this podcast. And he told me that if someone asks you a question that you don't have an interesting answer for, you're allowed to ignore it and say a tangentially related story that kind of fits. Which is what I did when I mentioned about making worlds rather than being a writer as a kid. And I genuinely didn't know that. I thought that if someone asked you a question, you had to directly answer it. And if you didn't have a good answer, you just had to say yes or no and leave it there, even though that's a conversation stopper. So that's something I might plausibly put in the whippet because I think it's useful to know.
I do say that to other writers when we're talking about when your book first comes out and you start having to do interviews and things.
Right.
And that art of a good interview is exactly what you're talking about, that if the question is not really resonating or you don't have a response to that question, is to veer off into something that is relevant or an answer. You see, university lecturers are always good at that too.
Yeah.
You often think, God, I asked such a good question and really you didn't ask that good a question at all.
Yeah, I just, it's so much that I guess it's also that thing of me being like, well, you have to answer the question. That's the rule, is that you answer the question. And so, yeah, I need to learn that there are other rules that fit as well. It also just comes up sometimes when someone does something that I find really annoying. And then I go, oh God, I do that too. And so then I'm like, okay, I need to stop. And everyone else needs to stop. Everyone has to stop doing this thing.
It's a community service. McKinley, is there anything you wish you knew when you were starting out with the whippet that you know now?
Certainly that thing I was talking about either decide to go all in with marketing or just accept slow growth and don't stress about it. And also the idea of, I've forgotten where I was going with that. I'm sorry. There was a thing that happened. There was a moment when I was writing the whippet where it was something that I'd read that I found interesting, and it was on the names for different foot shapes. And I thought, no one in the world is going to be interested in this beside me. Literally no one. This is so self-indulgent. But I put it in anyway because I decided, am I writing for a broad audience? Am I a copywriter in this, or am I writing what I think is interesting? And I went with what I think, even though I didn't expect anyone else to like it. And I was on David Astell's radio show, which is it Drive? Anyway, and he specifically mentioned that toe shape article as being one of the things that interested him. So I was like, you just don't know. Like, you can't guess other people's interests, and it's not worth it to try. It never really works. The other thing I guess I would say is either organize to have a proofreader, or if you can't, just make peace with errors. Like, I am an editor for money, and I know how to edit something so that it will not have errors. But the Whippet is full of errors, and that's because I do it last minute and I don't get anyone to proofread it. And I'm not really willing to put in the time and effort that it would take to make it perfect, because it goes out every 2 weeks. You know, it's not like a book that you are sending off and it's your one chance kind of thing. So if you decide to do that, don't freak out when someone points out an error, because it's the price you've paid, and, you know, it's just how it is.
There is no better way to identify an error, though, than pushing the button publish or send. Yes. It's like suddenly they all just come to the surface. That's terrible. Final question, tips and tricks for people wanting to start or grow newsletters.
I think that committing to a schedule is really, really important. It's been really important for me, both for the reasons that I spoke about, but also for combating imposter syndrome. If you know that your newsletter has to go out on Thursday, then on Wednesday night, you don't really get to decide what I've written isn't good enough, because it's got to go out. And honestly, you're probably a terrible judge about whether it's good enough anyway. So it's good that you have to stand out of your own way and let it happen. So I do think, even if that schedule is, you know, once every 79 days, like, it doesn't have to be weekly or whatever, but do commit to it. I think that is really, really important. And I guess that other one about, if you have the thought, no, this is too weird, no one is going to be interested in this besides me, go for it. See how you go.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website, or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.